We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and let's wrap up this talk of terrorism and the situation in the U.S. in this segment. But I want to talk more generally about the costs of the war on terror, or the costs of the attacks of September 11th. Tell me if you remember this, or ask yourself if you remember this. Do you remember the ad that came out right after 9/11, where it showed a typical American, it wasn't really a street, I guess it was a row of townhouses on each side of a street, and it said, "Something has changed in America. The terrorists thought they could change our lives. They could cause us to fear," whatever they said. And they said, and they were right, they did cause us to change. And then the scene shows an American flag flying from every house. Well, it's a nice upbeat message, and I'd like to believe it, but here's the problem. Terrorism does actually change you, right? The terrorists have succeeded in costing us a great deal of time and money, right? Because what they've done is they've changed our way of life. And it really comes down to where your fear level's at. So they use box cutters to bring our planes down, and suddenly we screen everything. You couldn't even bring tweezers onto an airplane for the first couple of years after 9/11. Now I think you can take your tweezers and your nail clippers on, but you can't take scissors. And then the shoe bomber tried to strike, Richard, what's his name? And suddenly we all remove our shoes when we get to the airport. I was in three airports in the last 4 days. And every time I take my shoes off, I put them on a belt so they can x-ray them, and I go through. Now, wouldn't you think there'd be some way for us to, let's just start with the 1 million people who are the most frequent flyers in America, and I'm probably not among them. But let's just start with them. Good, loyal Americans who have no intention of ever blowing up anything, but they'd like to keep their shoes on going through the line, or they'd like to be able to take a bottle of water through and onto the plane instead of having to buy it inside. And yet, we have no way to do that. 80-year-old grandmothers are being pulled out of the line and patted down because they were chosen at random. Where is our sense of proportion here? This is what terrorism costs societies. And we aren't the first to learn this. You know, right after 9/11, Bush was lecturing Europe about the dangers of terrorism and how they needed to side with us. And the Europeans were laughing at him, because they've been dealing with terrorists for 30 years. They were trying to convince us terrorism was serious. Britain dealt with it, with the IRA, for 30 years. It's why London was the most surveilled city in the world long before September 11th. Germany dealt with it. Denmark dealt with it. A whole variety of countries dealt with terrorism. They knew what they were up against. But we got hit by 9/11, and we suddenly think that we're special. Now, admittedly, that was a huge attack, much bigger than anything Europe ever saw. But they were already dealing with terrorism. And I can tell you this, they didn't put Jersey barriers around their national treasures. This is where the level of fear is a little out of hand. I don't want them to blow up the Jefferson Memorial, but I don't want the Jersey barriers around the Jefferson Memorial. I think I've told the story on the air. I took a crew of volunteers through a program the National Park Service has and through Singles Volunteers of D.C., and I led the group of volunteers, and we painted all the Jersey barriers around the Jefferson Memorial one weekend. And instead of that dull gray, we painted it in beautiful puke brown. But they still got 167 Jersey barriers ringing the Jefferson Memorial. Why? So some terrorists can't drive a truck up and blow up Thomas Jefferson inside his memorial? We can rebuild memorials. If the terrorists want to do damage, they'll drive a truck full of bombs into a school. But this is, to me, an example of our irrational levels of fear. there used to be a little parking lot. There is a little parking lot at the Jefferson Memorial. And seeing the monuments at night is a beautiful thing. And so whenever I have guests come into town, I'll often take them down at night. And what used to be great was you could drive right up to the Jefferson Memorial and park there and walk into the memorial and then drive around to the FDR Memorial and park, because these little parking lots had spaces in them at night. Now they've totally blocked off that parking lot. You can't use it. Americans are not allowed to use that parking lot near the Jefferson Memorial. Why? Because we're afraid. That's a mistake. That's how the terrorists have won. So when people say to you, everything's changed since 9/11, no, everything hasn't actually changed. Our perception of everything has changed. Europeans already knew about the terrorist threats. 9/11 drove it home in spades, but it was a wake-up call for us. But we overreacted. We gave President Bush too much power. We allowed Bush and Cheney's fears to run us. And they led us into Iraq. Now, you can argue they were not being truthful to us, and they didn't actually fear Saddam at the level they said. But there's only one or two answers with Iraq. Either President Bush and Dick Cheney really believed what they said, that Saddam Hussein was a direct threat to the U.S. homeland, and that we couldn't afford to leave him in power. Either they believe that, in which case they OD'd on fear and were not fit to lead the country, because Saddam was never a threat to the U.S. homeland. That was clear to me then and to a lot of Americans. But Bush and Cheney played the fear card, and they kept beating the drums for war, and war they got. So it's either that they were too fearful and not fit to lead with that level of fear, because you got to have some balance, or they knew that he wasn't a threat, but they wanted to go to war, so they manipulated the American people. I prefer to think that they didn't lie to us. So I think they are just too afraid. And so, you know, I want to elect people who aren't going to be that fearful. And so far, what I see on the Republican side, in Giuliani in particular, is a level of fear that disqualifies him from being president. Now, he wants to go out and say that the Democrats aren't serious about national security. You hear the talk show host say that. You hear Britt Hume say it, a man who's supposed to be a reporter on Fox News. No, it's not that the Democrats aren't serious about national security. It's that the Republicans are too afraid. And so everywhere they look, they see danger lurking. I'm not saying we don't protect the borders. Of course you look for nuclear weapons coming in through container ships or whatever it is. Those would be the first level of danger. But to take the terrorist threat and whip up the fear in the American people is irresponsible and not fit for people who want to hold national office. So we'll have to see how the next election cycle goes, but I'm just tired of not being able to take a bottle of water or a can of soda through the airport screening system and then get on an airplane with it. And I'm tired of having to take off my shoes. And I'm tired of seeing jersey barriers around some of our national monuments. We need smart screening. We need reasonable levels of concern about these things. Let's go back to surveillance for a minute. So, this whole issue of warrantless surveillance, have you thought about it much? Because for a lot of people, they don't understand the issues. And so they think, well, you know, the government should be able to do this. They might catch terrorists. Yeah, that's true. They might. But they might also just further infringe our rights. Like taking off your shoes infringes our rights. Like the jersey barriers around the monuments infringe on our rights. Like not being able to take a scissors in your carry-on luggage infringes on your rights. the law that they're planning to extend is based on fear. Right? America has never allowed the government to eavesdrop at the level they're eavesdropping. And let me tell you, the whole story of the eavesdropping has not been told. There's a Frontline documentary documentary that took place a year or two ago. And basically, there's a AT&T switching station, central office switch in San Francisco, where the government went in, National Security Agency went in, built a little room beside it, and started setting up computers and siphoning off all the records from millions of phone calls and millions of emails. And AT&T isn't even allowed to talk about it and confirm it took place. But there was one engineer in particular that got suspicious because he saw what was happening with the computer system and with the data and phone records. And so Frontline did this expose, but it's pretty clear what's going on. The Bush administration has taken a lot more power to itself than simply saying, well, FISA law, it's outdated. That was 1978. We now have cell phones. We now have throwaway cell phones. We now have to be able to track people that use sophisticated ways to change from one phone to another. FISA courts would handle all that. The thing that they would not get permission for would be to cull through millions of email messages and millions of phone calls looking for who knows what. And the killer is the Bush administration says, trust us to do this. You don't need oversight from a court. We should have these new freedoms or new permissions. And don't worry your pretty little head. We'll promise that we won't abuse the information. I mean, this administration hasn't kept more than 5% of the promises it's made or claims it's made to the American people. Why would we think they'd keep this one? And I'm not saying there's people immediately going out there to say, oh, I'm going to abuse this law. I want to look up my wife's sister's phone records or whatever it is. No, it's not that there's an immediate plan to abuse it. It's that when you put power into the hands of one group and you tell them for oversight, you keep an eye on yourselves. You are asking for trouble. Our founding fathers knew that. We know it instinctively. But the people that usually scream about these things when Democrats are in office, the talk show hosts, the pundits who have conservative principles, they all roll over when it's a conservative or Republican administration that wants to do it. And they say, trust us. Well, tell me, are you going to trust a President Hillary with the same power you're willing to give to George W. Bush? If you're a Republican or a conservative, I want you to think hard about that answer. I think you know what that answer is.
Well, talk to him tonight.
We are back on the Andy Finn Show, and in this last segment, I want to talk about Alan Greenspan. Now, we're talking about the former chair of the Federal Reserve, and a guy who, at whatever advanced age he's at, and I forget how old he is, no, I guess he's in his 80s, he's 81 or something, he's married to Andrea Mitchell. I think she's still with CBS, but here's an 81-year-old guy married to, how can I say it? There's no nice way to say it about an anchor woman like this. She's a babe. Anyway, Greenspan has a new book out, and so this is in the news this week. And it turns out his memoirs, which are being released today, he is disappointed with President Bush's economic policies. And so he's gone on the attack, and Bush isn't even out of office yet. So he's a lifelong Republican, and he gets a lot of credit for running the Fed because he presided over the longest sustained economic expansion in American history. And what's interesting is that he should have more closer allies in the Republican Party than in the Democratic Party, for example, when Clinton was in office. But in fact, he really finds fault with the current administration and what they've done in the last 6 years. And it primarily comes down to this. He met frequently with Bush and with Cheney, but he basically discovered that they weren't interested in taking much of his advice. We had a Republican president, Republican Congress, and they spent like drunken sailors. Right? Here's quoting Greenspan in an interview he did for the book. Quote, I'm just very disappointed. Smaller government, lower spending, lower taxes, less regulation. They had the resources to do it. They had the knowledge to do it. They had the political majorities to do it. And they didn't. So basically, he argues that they should have taken action and basically cut spending so that we wouldn't have the budget deficit we do and the economy would be in better shape. There's a little problem with this, Mr. Greenspan. You supported Bush's tax cuts in 2001. And then when he wanted to make them Greenspan agrees with making them permanent, strangely enough. I don't see how you balance the budget if you make them permanent. We're talking $1.7 trillion in tax cuts, or maybe it's $1.9 trillion, over 10 years. When those 10 years are coming to an end here during the next president's administration, and the Republicans are all screaming that if you don't make the tax cuts permanent, it's a tax increase. Well, we've been through this before. That is a sleight of hand kind of thing. Do you remember when Social Security, the Republicans wanted to, I guess, and Medicare, let's say, the Republicans wanted to cut the rate of growth in Medicare, right? Instead of letting it grow according to inflation or 3% a year, they wanted to cut that rate of growth to like 2%. I'm making these numbers up. I don't remember what the real numbers were. And when people said, you're cutting Medicare, all the talk show hosts on the right were out there saying, no, no, it's not a cut. We're just slowing the rate of growth. Well, why doesn't the same logic apply here? Bush administration put tax cuts in place with the specific intent they would only last 10 years. Some of them a little less, but roughly 10 years. Now, the chickens are coming home to roost. The tax cuts are over. This is what Bush could squeeze out of Congress. It was all he could squeeze. And now they want to say it's a tax increase. No, it just means that the tax cuts that you offered, the temporary tax cuts you offered, were over. These are not tax increases. The gravy train is over. Right? All we're doing is restoring the rates that you agreed would be restored when you put the cuts in place. Bush couldn't have got permanent tax cuts through the Congress because the sea of red ink it would have shown would have been unacceptable. So he used the bait and switch and said, go for these, knowing that the argument now would be, oh, well, you're increasing taxes. Anyway, Greenspan is a party to all this. He's not held the line on all of this. Okay, basically, he knew what the tax cuts were going to do to the economy, to the deficits, to the debt. The Bush administration and the Reagan administration, the two combined, have driven our national debt up more than not just more than any two presidents in history, it's not even close. So the whole deal here with Alan Greenspan being upset with the Bush administration, it's nice you're upset, but you had a chance to do something about it when you were in office, and you gave testimony to Congress that helped Bush get his way with these tax cuts. The other thing is, Greenspan was in favor of the war in Iraq, okay? But he claims that not because Saddam had WMD, but because Saddam was trying to capture the supply, the oil supplies of the Middle East, okay? Arguing that Iraq was a far greater threat than Iran to the world scene. Well, what he's forgetting about that, it's true that Saddam was aggressive. He went into Kuwait, and the Saudis were properly concerned that he might go into Saudi Arabia if he wasn't challenged. But he was challenged. And after he got beat, we reduced him to a pretty powerless force. And so this whole issue, that this whole notion that from Greenspan's point of view that Iraq was a greater threat, no, they were very weakened. By the time George Bush went into Iraq, Iraq was weakened tremendously. The weapons inspectors had made sure that he didn't have WMD. The no-fly zones meant that he couldn't move and take action against the Kurds in the north or the Shia in the south. And we were bombing him a couple times a week because he was firing back at our planes that were doing flyovers. So his army and everything was a shell of its former self, which we discovered and we suspected and discovered when we went in. And yet, Greenspan wants us to believe that Iraq was a greater threat than Iran to the world scene at that point. It's true, Saddam had been belligerent. He was unpredictable. He wasn't very smart about how he handled things. But that country was contained before he went in. Anyway, let me close with a couple of things Greenspan said that is mildly entertaining here, because he talked in his book about all the presidents that he dealt with, and he's worked with every president since he signed on in 1967 as an advisor to Nixon, except Jimmy Carter. And Nixon is the one he's least impressed with. Listen to this quote from Alan Greenspan about Richard Nixon. Quote, "When Nixon left office, I was relieved. You didn't know what he might do, and the president of the United States has so much power that it's scary." He argued that, he said that he sat in a meeting and was turned off when advisors with him, when Nixon discussed, quote, how the Democrats were the enemy in a profanity-laden discussion that, quote, would have made Tony Soprano blush. He liked Jerry Ford. He said he always understood what he knew and what he didn't know, and he was secure in himself. One of those rare people who would actually score normal in psychological tests. I think there's more normal people than you think there, Alan. And then with Reagan, quote, he brought a sunniness and benevolence to the presidency that never wavered, even when he had to deal with a dysfunctional economy and the global danger of nuclear war. Under Reagan, Americans went from believing they were a former great power to regaining their self-confidence. I don't remember it getting that bad. I know that he saw the shining city on the hill, but I don't remember not having self-confidence in ourselves as a government. It's true that post-Vietnam, we were a little gun-shy of going around the global block looking for heads to knock. But, of course, he's a Republican, so he's going to build Reagan up. But he also had a lot of good things to say about Clinton. He believed that, quote, the president probably had a better hands-on feel for the economy than the economists, this is Clinton, because he understood technology's impact. And they were both fellow information hounds, so he got along pretty well with Clinton. And he's arguing that Bush's collaborate but confront was a major mistake, and that the checks and balance systems has suffered under George W. Bush. And of course that's true, that's what we've been talking about all evening. So with that, let's get out of here. We'll be back next Monday night at 9:30 for another edition of the Andy Finn Show. In the meantime, check out my website, andyfinn.us. That's andyfinn.us. And until then, remember, do it. Don't doubt it.